Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 356. I'm Patrick Gray. And we got a great show for you this week. We're probably going to run a little bit over time, but that's okay because it is all good stuff in this week's podcast. Mostly we're over time because of this week's terrific feature interview with Yahoo CSO Alex Stamos. He talks about his encounter with NSA Admiral Mike Rogers, which made headlines last week. He also talks about security at scale, bug bounties, and more. It is great stuff, and it's coming up after this week's news. This week's show is brought to you by Senetas, makers of fine, fine encryption hardware. Senetas co-founder and CTO Julian Fay will join us this week to talk about all the news from the world of crypto that's been going on in the last couple of weeks. The freak bug, the new crypto wars, HTTP2, and more. But before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good pal, Adam Boileau. And Adam, first up, you know, there was a big hoo-ha. You know, the Department of Justice in the United States was getting very upset at Google for its plans to release an encrypted by default Lollipop Android operating system. Apparently, Google has now decided to back away from turning that on by default. You can still turn it on, but it's not on by default, and that's due to performance considerations.
Yeah, it's interesting because they made quite a big song and dance about turning this on. I mean, there was Google talking about it in the Washington Post a while ago about how they would have strong crypto and how it would be on by default from out of the box. And that was true of for Lollipop device, and that was true of the most recent Google Nexus phones. But yeah, what's interesting is that now we are actually seeing brand new, like not upgraded old devices, brand new devices coming from other vendors. I mean, Motorola and Samsung are the main ones that we're talking about here, where this isn't turned on by default for, as you say, for performance reasons. And you can imagine, for stuff that's being upgraded, like if you've got old, older gen Samsung gear or whatever that you're upgrading, you can imagine they might turn it off. But it does seem to be that, the newer devices don't. And, there's discussion that it's because of the support for the hardware accelerated crypto and the CPU is not really there yet, so it makes the performance awful. But either way, as consumers buying devices on the basis of Google's assertions about security and privacy in the press, not really matching up with the reality of the devices being shipped, which is is pretty uncool.
Staying with all things mobile and Silent Circle, it looks like they're going to be a full stack provider. They're snapping up the hardware concern that makes their device. Is that right?
Yeah, so originally, the Silent Circle Black Phone thing was a joint venture project, and they've acquired the Geeks Phone stake in the Black Phone project. So that does give them control of the whole thing end to end, which, obviously you've only got one vendor to worry about, I suppose, which makes their lives a bit easier. That'll, I think, be good for the device.
Rightio. And, it has been a big week for mobile news. Apparently now, what's that, Moxie's app, his mobile app, now you've got sort of interoperability between iPhone and, Android devices. This is actually kind of a big deal. It's like, WhatsApp that you can't wiretap.
Yeah, this is quite a cool thing. I mean, the Signal app was able to do cross-platform between iOS and Android voice, but we didn't have interop for Tech Secure, and that's now been rolled out. So you can do text messaging between Apple and Android platforms, and that's really cool. Signal as an app, if you use it, is really Moxie's really been trying to nail the usability to make the security features of that be usable for the general public, and it works by and large very, very well. So yeah, this is a big step.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm just wondering here. I'm guessing that if you're using Signal, it's less likely. It's more likely that there will be features baked into that which will tell you if you're being manned in the middle compared to something like WhatsApp, which might eventually be required. Facebook might be required to provide law enforcement with an interception capability on that and disable warnings. You're guessing that's going to be less likely under a architecture that's been designed by Moxie.
Yeah, well, it's primarily about user interface. We've got, in theory, end-to-end or at least reasonable crypto with iMessage, with WhatsApp, with some of the other messaging suites, but we don't have, as users, any visibility of the keying. And that is a thing that Signal does put in there so that you can verify it if you need to. Yeah. Whereas, obviously, corporate sponsored man in the middle by the vendors of these things, is not a thing at the moment we could spot with iMessage.
Nokia spin-off Jolla has actually revealed a new mobile OS, and it's very much privacy focused. I should mention too that John Brooks, who's designing, who designed and coded up Ricochet, which is part of the Invisible IM project, he works. He does a lot of contracting for these guys, but this looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the spin-off of Mego, which was the spin-off of the Linux-based mobile OS that Intel worked with Nokia on back in the early 2000s. But essentially, yes, it's Linux for mobile with a nice mobile-focused interface, and this is a particular variant that's meant to be more secure. And the story says that Jolla are partnering with the SSH people, like the actual commercial SSH vendor, which is also Finnish, to make a more privacy, more security focused mobile OS. Given that they're attempting to go into a marketplace where iOS and Android are the only real incumbent vendors that you have to care about, they've got to do something that differentiates themselves from the Samsung has been, the Tizen that Samsung's trying to push, and the Firefox mobile and the Ubuntu mobile, none of which seem to have much real reason why you'd want to use them, and this gives them some differentiation. So it'd be interesting to see if it succeeds. Obviously, it's a really hard market to break into.
It is, and we'll have to see what the interface is like as well, because they're not exactly coming out with a head start. It's a mature market now, so it'll be interesting to see if they can actually get there. And I'm glad it's not just me who's confused about the pronunciation of that one. Is it Jolla? Is it Yola?
Please let us know, Finns. I mean, Finnish is so hard to pronounce anyway. Who knows what the hell it is. Sounds like pronounced Flergel.
Sounds like English backwards, doesn't it? Now, Tim Cook of Apple has come out swinging against the man. He made an extremely strongly worded statement, really pushing back on the government about surveillance stuff. This is, this is real battle lines rhetoric. He's made it exceedingly clear what he thinks of, the US government's intrusions into people's communications.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the statements that I guess we've we've talked about over the years, of Apple, kind of focusing on products rather than on data mining or on advertising as their business model, and if you're not paying, you're not you're the product kind of thing. But actually, to really come out and say it very strongly, and to say that this is not just a business model thing, this is our corporate ethical choice, and that we are going to lead by example and show the government how to respect people's privacy whilst still being free and open and happy and democratic society, which is quite a for a CEO to say that, especially of the most valuable company by market cap in the world, it's quite a strong statement.
It certainly is. And, it's a strong statement that is needed because according to this next piece in the Register, now this came as a surprise to me because as far as I thought the call metadata retention program being run by the NSA, where they hoover up all of the United States, call records into a giant, creepy 1984 government database, I thought that program was shut down. The president announced that it was going to be shut down. Apparently it's being extended till June. So it is still up and running. I mean, it's really like you just think, how is this tolerated? I mean, you've had one court already rule that it's unconstitutional, another rule that it's okay. The Supreme Court's saying, well, we're staying out of this. So, I'm just really surprised that it's still rolling.
Well, exactly right. I mean, you would imagine that, I guess I don't want to be completely cynical, but I mean, this whole thing of, Obama comes up and says, yes, we're going to stop this because, clearly it needs reviewing. For most people, that's the end of it. I mean, you assume that if he says that, then that's probably going to happen. But it's been, extended five times since then?
Yeah.
and the rationale, rationale for reapproving that the Foreign Intelligence Service Court gave was that, they have to figure out how to fill the capability gap that will be left before we can really turn it off.
Otherwise, how will we arrest taxi drivers who are sending money to family members who are part of some militia in Somalia? I mean, how else will we stop that, Adam?
How else indeed?
Moving to some more traditional security news. And, the SSL, the Decentralized SSL Observatory, has pumped out a bunch of interesting research. And, they've turned up some really interesting man-in-the-middle attacks that are sort of like based on similar products or similar, poor architectures as things like that Superfish thing. So they've actually found examples of people being man-in-the-middled, through similar crapware.
Yeah, I mean, the guts of this, I guess, is that Superfish as a product actually bought their SSL intercept bit from another vendor called Commodia, and that SSL interception proxy product has a particular style of SSL certificate that it uses so that you can, for having the browser not display a warning when it's getting man in the middle with their root CA cert that they've dropped. Anyway, so this observatory have enough data to spot those types of certs in the wild, and then from that infer that people were using this in the wild to do other things or to attack people who were using this library. And it turns out actually there's a bunch of products other than the Superfish malware, or the malware product advertising platform, whatever, that use this Comodio library.
Yeah, it's really
library.
Splitting so, hairs. I mean, let's not talk semantics here.
Yeah. I mean, this is used in things like parental content filtering and, you know, proxies and anything else. And basically, anything that needs to get in the middle of SSL. This is one of the products that you could buy if you were building a product that did that. And they've identified actually on the basis of these certificates that they're finding in the wild, other vendors that we don't yet know about that are actually using these libraries. Mm. There's some in Norway, there's some in South America that haven't previously been discussed. So it's certainly interesting research if you've been following this, you know, the Superfish escalating into, you know, Proof Dog and then, you know, yeah, everyone else who is a Comodio customer.
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't know why we thought that, you know, Lenovo would be the only one doing dumb things on the internet, you know?
Well, they're certainly doing a few dumb things on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, look, speaking of Lenovo, Lenovo.com, actually, Adam, we spoke about that last week. Their domain had got jacked and it was serving up pictures of, like, emo kids and there was jacked mail and stuff. It turns out that it was, surprise, surprise, a hack on an upstream registrar. I mean, you know, color me surprised.
Yeah, so it looks like Lizard Squad are claiming that they owned webnick.cc, which was the upstream registrar via a command injection bug in the web interface, and that they owned the box and then used that to change the domains over to point to their, you know, Cloudflared site with the, you know, pictures of emo kids on it. So, Webnick, I believe, is actually offline, or at least certainly was at the time that this particular piece went up on Ars, dealing with presumably some fairly bad incident response. So the moral of the story is, yes, please use reputable registrars instead of rubbish ones that get hacked all the time via Cold Fusion, Cough, Melbourne IT. Yes, let's move on before I badmouth them some more.
Well, it's funny. I was just going to say we can move on now because you've managed to get in your Melbourne IT jab for the week. Now, look, there is a Blu-ray disc out there that is very bad. It is very dangerous. It is a dangerous disc.
Yeah, so someone's come up with a way to do malware execution, so virus propagation via DVDs. And when you read the reason why, you will smack your head on the table, which is that the menuing systems that you get in DVDs, it turns out they're actually implemented kind of in Java. And so, of course, every DVD player software has a Java runtime in it and a bunch of classes that provide various Blu-ray player specific things that you can use for making, you know, apps on your Blu-ray discs. Needless to say, it runs Java. Somebody owned it. I am surprised.
So this affects DVDs and Blu-ray discs, right? And Blu-ray disc players. But because it's Java, it's cross-platform. You can actually own standalone players, right? I mean, it's just, you know, you're going to have a bad day when it's sort of something like Java. You know?
Yes, well, I mean, it is exactly Java, and it has, I mean, this particular exploit is being done through, there's an ARB file read in one of the classes that's provided by the Blu-ray, you know, kind of extensions to the Java runtime that it uses. So it's exactly what you would expect if an embedded device runs Java. You plug in a thing, you supply code, and oh, look, I've owned it. How terrible. I mean, this particular example is in the Blu-ray extensions.
Yeah.
The Blu-ray, like Java classes provided with for that environment. So I'm, I don't know. I'm pretty sure we have seen people do similar sort of things with the DVD runtime as well. But yeah, this particular example targets Power DVD on Windows and some embedded devices, I believe.
Mm. Now, Uber. Uber having a pretty bad week.
They are, yeah. So, yeah, last week we covered the fact that there was a data breach at Uber. They lost a bunch of data about drivers who are, you know, driving for them. Turns out the root cause analysis for that is in, and it is that they posted private keys to gists on GitHub, which...
Yeah, but I mean, this is, you know, it's really easy to point and laugh at them and go, ha, 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 you idiots, but it's such a common thing, you know, and so many people, so many attackers out there are just crawling websites like Git looking for keys because it's such a common thing. So I think there was a post I read a couple of weeks ago about someone who, or maybe a couple of months ago, about someone who'd accidentally published a key onto GitHub and pulled it down within 30 seconds and it was too late. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just...
Well, that is the kind of point of a, you know, revision control system, is you can spot revisions where people remove stuff. But no, yes, absolutely right. I mean, this is certainly a technique that we as attackers use. I mean, we've done exactly this on customer engagements, you know, mine open source intel for creds or private keys or whatever.
And well, I think GitHub itself actually spends a lot of time trawling through its own, you know, all material on its site so that they can alert customers to this sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? So it's a known problem, but yeah, it's a real shame that it had to Impact Uber, which is a company you'd think would know better. Now, Apple Pay. This is a great story here that comes to us via the Register. You know, I've been waiting for this story to appear, really, because it seemed to me that Apple Pay, I was wondering how you're going to load your cards into it. Do you know what I mean? How are you going to load your cards into it and have that not be a problem? How are we going to stop someone else from loading my card into their device? Turns out that is not just me. It is difficult. It is difficult. And the fraud is already apparently in the millions.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, for those of you who haven't used Apple Pay or even some of the other mobile payment options, right? I mean, essentially, there is some process for enrolling your card into your phone so that your phone can then use as NFC to pretend by a radio to be a credit card. So you enroll it as a credit card, which you will notice is completely indistinguishable from credit card cloning.
And that except is exactly it does go for verification in some step of the process. And I think that's where it's breaking down, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm getting through is that the enrollment process is, you know, you put in your credit card number or whatever, and then there's an out-of-band communication or communication from your phone back to Apple and then onwards to the banks, so the bank can validate that based on the information provided by Apple that you are the legitimate owner of this card. And needless to say, that validation process is the key thing that prevents fraud using this kind of Apple Pay NFC payment stuff. And of course, as you would expect, the banks really didn't think about that very well, or at least some of the banks haven't understood the importance of that process. And at least one of the banks in the US is allowing people to validate this via like a phone-based IVR that just asks for the last four digits of your social security number.
Geez, and those are so hard to find.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's just they I don't know what the hell they were thinking, because I mean, it's, what you've taken is like all of the benefits that we've made, all the strides we've made over the last few years of making card not present transactions better. To make them closer to card present. Now what we're doing is we're really just tearing that down and gluing those two back together and making them, making it so much easier for people.
Yeah, we're going to have to wait and see if they can actually update the processes and make it less of an issue, because...
Well, I mean, the problem is that the process is going to be per bank, right? And we're just going to see... Yeah. We're going to be in exactly the same situation we are with anywhere else. You let the banks make their own decisions, as each individual bank will screw it up individually and then learn their lesson, and the whole industry, and especially Apple. I mean, well, actually, maybe it won't be that bad, because I mean, Apple has got a pretty big stick to wave around.
Yeah, they do. They can kick you out of the program, right? So
yeah, I guess Apple are probably pretty conscious of the impact on their brand if people think it's going to be rubbish. But I mean, it's just they've got themselves into such a sticky situation of trying to ruining all the good moves we've made to try and improve credit card.
Well, let's not say it's all ruined yet, but it's certainly not an encouraging sign. Speaking of credit card shenanigans, Krebs on Security is carrying what Krebs on Security likes to carry, which is a story about a credit card breach at Mandarin Oriental, the hotel group. Also, apparently, at some Whole Foods market as well. I mean, you can go check out this week's show notes and click through to them. Credit card breach stories are, just barely newsworthy these days, which is such a depressing thing. There's also a story on the Register here. Now, this one is interesting. The Sands Hotel Group was hacked in Las Vegas, and they did a pretty effective job of sort of covering it up. We were contacted, I was contacted by someone who was pretty close to that job, who told me that it was absolute scorched earth and that their entire, all of their AD stuff got hosed, and it was a proper nightmare. And more details are starting to emerge. Even the US Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, is actually talking about this one now. And, the rumor has been going around for quite a while that it was Iran behind this, due to comments made by the chairman about Israel or something like that. It's just interesting seeing this now used by the Director of National Intelligence as an example of a state-based attack against a US organization.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the rhetoric that comes out of this really shifting from the traditional, cyber Pearl Harbor, they're going to blow up our nuclear power plants and destroy our SCADA systems, that we've previously seen used to justify that cyber is important or something, to now we're just going to see, like rubbish actors like North Korea and Iran going around owning, low-hanging fruit corporates and burning them to the ground as sort of an ongoing sort of, low-level rumble of economic warfare rather than the Pearl Harbor thing. And it's just... like that's to you and I guess seems, your end of year show last year basically said that this is the new normal that we're going to expect, but seeing that now, you know, that's Cyber Pearl Harbor rhetoric being backed off and this being...
By a guy like Clapper as well. It's like, hey, wow, you've grown up and you're not trying to scare everyone. You're actually saying sensible stuff. So that is interesting, and it is interesting seeing that used as a case study. Meanwhile, in Australia, the cops have arrested some guy, some Australian Anon, who was like getting real rowdy on YouTube, you know, telling people to hacks ASIO and ASIS because of spying or something. I mean, you can jump into that one in the show notes if you're interested. Krebs also has an interesting story here about a hospital suing Bank of America over some funny transactions.
Yeah, so this was a bank, a hospital got owned, you know, via phishing, whatever you would expect, and then they were being done in the payroll scam, so like making unauthorized payroll, large payroll payments, and they are actually suing the bank for not spotting those transactions as fraud. And the interesting thing is that actually one of these transactions, which was for like $600,000, right, not a small amount of money, the bank noticed that it was bit weird, phoned them up, asked them, did you authorize a payment for $600,000? Hospital said no, the bank did it anyway.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe this could be something to this lawsuit.
Maybe, but yeah, so I mean, it's certainly not the first time we've seen someone in this situation of commercial banking where you have much less protection than you do as a, you know, private citizen banking, go after the banks through civil lawsuits. But, you know, there's a reasonable amount of money involved, you know, over $1 million. So see how it goes for Bank of America.
Now, here in Australia, the government's plan to introduce mandatory data retention of things like, you know, subscriber IP details and telephone call records as well, which would stay with the telcos and the ISPs, that is progressing. But something very funny happened this week, you know, sort of in relation to that. Our Attorney General, George Brandis, had a brainwave and hooked up his iPhone, like his iMessage account, to his Australian Parliament House email address, which is public. And the goatsies began pretty much within about 3 microseconds of people figuring that one out. There's a few of them too. It wasn't just him, but he's the Attorney General and he's not very popular, and holy dooly.
And you can imagine, yes, the internet got hold of that relatively quickly. And someone posted on Twitter, right, I think. And then it escalated horribly, horribly from there. So if you're in other countries, listeners, it might behoove you to go check what of your politicians have accidentally registered their accounts with iMessage. And then you too can go to your politicians or other such forms of political protest.
And if you fire off one of those messages and you see the little blue bubble with delivered under it, you know.
Then you wait for the read indication.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend trying this in Russia, though. You know what I mean? Like, do it somewhere where they're not going to like attach electrodes to your pink bits if you get caught.
Yeah, I'm sure Putin has no f-ing sense of humor lately.
Yeah. When did he ever? You know, he's not his own. good old Chuckles over there in Russia. We'll just run through a few vulnerability stories here. Seagate Business NAS, you know, their network attached storage, their firmware. There's a whole bunch of vulnerabilities that have been disclosed in that. You might want to look into that if you're using Seagate Kit.
Those are particularly funny bugs, and also were discovered by Australian local OJ, who does listen to the show, I
Mr.
believe.
Mr. Reeves, so, there you go. Hey, yes. Nice one, OJ. D-Link, shipping a whole bunch of updates. You know, D-Link, typical dumb bugs for embedded devices, you know, and that's interesting in light of, you know, another piece by Krebs where, you know, a bunch of spammers using default passwords on routers to do stuff. I mean, they've actually turned into something that people actually attack these days, even though we've been saying for 10 years people are going to start attacking home routers. Guess what? People are starting to attack home routers, so might want to make sure they're all patched up. And finally, mate, Firefox, new edition of Firefox 37 is out, and they're including a certificate block list from 1CRL.
Yeah, so this the idea here is to replace or at least augment the certificate revocation process so that instead of having to phone out to an OCSP server every time, which is rubbish for performance, or having to push a new release of the browser every time to blacklist certificates, they're going to have some process where they can push out a certificate revocation list out to the Firefox clients.
Yeah, I mean, certificate revocation, the way browsers typically handle it, has always been just completely crackheaded, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It has been complete rubbish and is totally unworkable. And this is, you know, Mozilla attempting to come up with a better solution. And yes, it is a better solution, so good on you, Mozilla.
Well, the nice thing is, too, if you actually had man in the middle, like through wireless or whatever, you could actually stop browsers from being able to pull down the revocation lists, so they just ignore them.
It's just broken. It's a classic example of good crypto rubbish protocol for using the crypto.
Yeah, super broken, super bad. But, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
Sure, Pat. Talk to you then.
Insomnia Security's very own Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines, with big thanks to this week's sponsor, Senatas. Okay, before we get into this week's feature interview, a bit of housekeeping. I am going to be off to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre Conference in Canberra next month. This is a really interesting event, which is run by the Australian Signals Directorate. I think that's who runs it, even though the Australian Cybersecurity Centre is a multi-agency thing. Being in Canberra, I imagine there's going to be a lot of government people, a very heavy government presence. In the interest of disclosure, they agreed to fly me down there to attend the conference if I mentioned it a few times on the show. But look, I really think it's going to be worth going. Adam's going to be there as well. He's presenting. It should be good times. So yeah, if it wasn't on your con schedule, you should probably look it up because it looks like they really want to turn this one into a thing, into a bit of a fixture. Also, before we get into this week's feature, don't forget you can support the Risky Business Podcast yourself if you are interested. I set up a Patreon campaign to try to raise money to set up a dedicated studio for this show. You can head to patreon.com/riskybusiness. That's patreon.com/riskybusiness and set up a monthly patronage of whatever you want. Some people are chipping in $1 a month. One guy is putting in $100 a month. Personally, I think about $4 a month feels about right, $1 an episode. But whatever works for you is fine, even zero. It is not mandatory. I think we're up to about $720 US a month or something like that. So it's been pretty successful. I'm very, very happy and very grateful to all of those who have been contributing. So thanks for that. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Alex Stamos, CISO at Yahoo. Alex did a fantastic AppSec keynote in early February that I wanted to ask him about. So we booked this interview a couple of weeks ago, and then last week, Alex wound up in the news big time. He was on a panel with NSA Chief Admiral Mike Rogers at a conference, and Alex challenged Rogers on government murmurings about introducing laws to enforce interception capabilities on the products made by tech companies. Now, Alex asked Admiral Rogers if companies that agreed to introduce backdoors for the US government should also agree to provide similar backdoors to other countries' governments as well, you know, ones that might not be democratic. It was a curly question, respectfully asked, and from there was some to and fro. It was a cordial exchange, but it made the news. It was a real headline generator, this one. Alex joined me via Skype to discuss that exchange, security at scale, and bug bounties. Here he is.
You know, what I'm trying to do is point out to folks who talk about putting backdoors into software that, I understand their motivations, that the intelligence community and law enforcement have a legitimate problem with their adversaries all of a sudden using encryption all the time and quote unquote going dark. But they, you know, really need to think beyond just solving that problem and think about where they want to be in 10 years, right? And so, you know, what I was hoping to do with asking that question, and then, you know, through the rest of that week, I was meeting with folks both in the legislature and in other law enforcement intelligence agencies. Think about where we want to be in 10 years and then work backwards. Don't just think about solving the immediate problem because, you know, what – any decision that's made in the United States is going to have knock-on effects as for what other countries are going to do. And there's going to be real technical issues with trying to build backdoors in a way that doesn't weaken the overall security.
Well, the thing that I really don't understand, right, you look at something as simple as perfect forward secrecy, which is used by many, many, you know, large web properties. I'm guessing it's pretty much everywhere with you guys as well.
Yes, think, everywhere.
Yeah, like how on earth is the NSA or any other agency or the DOJ proposing that you could provide them sort of clear line interception into that without breaking absolutely everything? Like I really wonder if they understand the enormity of what it is that they're asking.
So right now, nobody's asking anything specific. That's one of the problems is that there's a little bit of shadow boxing going on here where there are general ideas of we need backdoors and encryption. We need to solve the going dark problem without specific legislation or specific language. So it's a little difficult to refute when there's no details. My concern is that, you know, my guess is that the U.S. government has actually learned since the Clipper chip debacle here in the U.S. in the 90s that nobody's expecting the government to propose use these encryption systems with these backdoors. I think what's more likely is that these folks are going to ask for expansion of the CALEA rules, which right now apply only to telecoms and don't apply to internet companies like ourselves, to make it our problem to do interception and then to turn over that data if required to under legal process. The challenge there is complying with CALEA means, you know, that gets rid of entire types of encryption and entire architectures that we would like to have, architectures where we don't have access to plain text. And so while that would be legislatively easier, it just shifts the technical problem and it greatly reduces our ability to keep our users safe.
But hang on. They are aware that we're talking about the internet here, right? And if, say, Yahoo all of a sudden comes under the CALEA program, or, you know, is required through regulation or legislation or whatever to actually provide interception, I mean, I'm just going to go use something else, right? That's maybe made in Liechtenstein. And what are they going to do about that? This is what I don't get. Like, how they think that they can actually tackle this problem by mandating crippled, you know, privacy across U.S. companies. It's like the worst thing you could do to the U.S. tech sector.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't see how it works globally. Certainly the government could do things that in the long run, even if it was fought and then the court cases turn out in the government's way, that could reduce this problem for if you're on the U.S. platforms. But like you said, there's nothing requires Americans or anybody else around the world to use U.S. platforms. And it is, you know, as an American, I really do feel like from a national greatness perspective, the balance here is that the U.S. tech sector should be trusted by everybody around the world, and we should build really secure products for Americans. There's no country in the world that's more exposed to security problems than the U.S. economy, right? There's no set of citizens that are more exposed than American citizens. It doesn't make sense for us to make our products less secure when our people are the ones who are going to suffer the most.
You know, there are already software tools out there that enable people with nefarious intent to communicate securely and privately. You know, there are plenty of them. So what I don't understand is why you would then go to all of these communications providers or online communications providers and say, we need an interception capability, when it is so clear to anyone who's up to no good that they can bypass it simply by using more niche tools. Does it actually get them where they want to go? Does it help?
One of the problems is there's a couple different discussions overlaid here. On the law enforcement side, they mix up transport security, which is what we're mostly concerned about, and end-to-end message security, which we're concerned about, with device encryption. The device encryption, I think, is where kind of local law enforcement is having trouble right now, because they're moving into a world where, you know, 5 years ago, if you picked up any random drug dealer off the street, they had tons of evidence on their phone, and you know, you could buy off-the-shelf forensics tools that you plug that phone in. It dumps it out in a way that the local sheriff's department can understand, and you needed no technological sophistication to use it. You know, it's very different than the intelligence community situation, where you're talking about individually targeted people, where you're popping basebands or you're using ODAs against the operating system. You know, for the local law enforcement, I think it's the device encryption that they're really getting kind of stuck on.
But I'm pretty sure they were able to secure convictions before smartphones were a thing. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
okay,
no,
guys, you had 5 or 6 years there where you had a golden era where all these guys would snitch on themselves because they were too stupid to, you know, they were sending emails and SMSs from their smart devices that stayed on their smart devices. But guess what? They were able to get, you know, they were able to get convictions through other means. So why are they crying that this is some huge loss in a capability that they've only had for a very brief time?
Well, no matter how long you had it, I think you're if you had a job like that, you'd never want to lose any capability. But I mean, my point that I'm trying to make is that kind of capability is probably gone no matter what, right?
Mm.
Because the adversaries know that you can't send, you know, you can't send a text message as a drug dealer saying your package has arrived. By the way, have you taken care of our friend yet, right? When you have 2 kilos of coke sitting there and yesterday somebody committed a murder, that you know you can't have unencrypted communications anymore. You can't carry around unencrypted phones in your pocket with your entire history. You can't carry around these GPS devices and they'll allow like towers to triangulate you. You know, that knowledge is out. That has nothing to do whether or not like American tech companies build products that are secure for our users.
Now, look, you made the point, and of course, we're going to move on to your AppSec talk in a moment. But, you know, you made the point that, you know, if you build this capability for the United States authorities, you operate in many jurisdictions, and there are many governments out there where, you know, obviously, if you can build that for the Americans, they're going to want that within their jurisdiction as well, as is their right, because you are operating in their countries. Do you think that the DOJ and the DOD have really thought that element of it through, where you could have a situation where Yahoo is providing an interception capability to a government that that is engaged in human rights abuses. I mean, and that I can only imagine what the compliance issues are there.
Right. It's a real sticky issue. Even without encryption, that's a very sticky issue that we try to minimize by requiring law enforcement to serve us with requests in a handful of jurisdictions where we feel there's appropriate legal controls in place. But the encryption issue makes that more of an issue, especially if a country is asking for the ability to decrypt it themselves, which again, the US isn't officially asking for anything. There's no proposed legislation, so it's difficult to analyze. But you can look, you know, just last week on, I believe, Thursday or Friday, it came out that the People's Republic of China, that the People's Congress has a draft bill that now requires the escrow of encryption keys. And from my, you know, non-lawyerly reading of an unofficial translation, it does seem to catch more than just end-to-end mail encryption. It seems like it would catch any use of TLS, any use of VPNs from an enterprise back to headquarters, that all of those keys would have to be escrowed so that the government itself could do decryption on demand. So certainly, I mean, whether or not, I know there are people in the government who are thinking about that, but it's going to be an unavoidable discussion now that other countries have black and white law where they're asking for these capabilities.
Yeah, now, I mean, Yahoo obviously had to do a bit of soul searching on that one because it copped an absolute shellacking many years ago when it handed over some information on dissidents. So I can understand why Yahoo, after that, you know, PR storm, negative PR storm, would actually be quite far ahead. Now, you know, I don't think, it doesn't seem to me anyway, like you set out to become a pinup for, you know, this sort of anti-NSA watching everything movement. It was just a few comments and an attempt at a sort of mature dialogue on a panel you were on. Were you surprised by the reaction to you just asking a couple of pretty tame questions?
Yeah, to be clear, I have no desire to be any kind of pinup, actually, Patrick.
Oh, really? Not even a 50 style, you know, sitting in a meadow, chewing some straw?
I was a little surprised. You know, I mean, I guess part of this is just the press characterizations are perhaps a little over the top. I feel like in the room, I asked a question respectfully and he answered it in a way that was good humored. And both of us had smiles on our faces.
And it comes across as Yahoo CISO goes to war with government.
Right.
I'm a journalist. I know how to write those headlines. Okay.
Yeah. I guess if you're a journalist and you're sitting in something called the New America Foundation, you know, conference on cybersecurity, if you have any ability to make it a little sexy, you're going to do that. I don't blame them for that. But I think my goal now is this discussion shouldn't be about my specific question to one part of the U.S. government. This is something that the entire tech industry needs to continue to make clear that, you know, we want to build secure products for our users and that we know that it is technically possible to build backdoors, but we don't believe it's technically possible to do that without introducing fundamental weaknesses into the security models of our products, and that is not the right thing for our users. And it's not the right thing for the United States.
But I mean, I guess some of the reaction over these comments has to stem from the fact that no one else in your position or an equivalent position is actually saying anything. So, I mean, you've got one person who comes and says, well, actually, you know, we're going to talk about this because this might be a bit of a problem from our perspective, which is, you know, as I say, pretty mild. And everyone latches onto it because it seems almost like that's the first time this has happened. Do you hope that that your contemporaries, that your peers really decide to get involved in this conversation? Because they've been a little bit mute, you would have to admit.
Yeah. Somebody who's been very out there in this conversation has been Tim Cook of Apple.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
I was in the audience for the cybersecurity summit. I, you know, saw this president speak and I saw Tim Cook speak, and I thought that took a lot of guts for him to stand up for the privacy of his users in a summit called by the president. And the president himself, in interviews that night with Recode, talked about his support for strong encryption. I mean, he did, you know, say that he wants to balance it with law enforcement needs. But, you know, I think one of the reasons there perhaps has not been a lot of talk here is you know, in the
US, there's nothing
proposed,
right?
There's nothing proposed, right? Yeah. And a lot of this stuff, you know, as much as we criticize our government, generally these kinds of things are pretty transparent, right? Like if something was going to happen, there would be proposed bills. They would come up in a committee and there would be some ability to respond. And so I think because there's no details and because there's no actual ticking clock timeline for legislation, that there hasn't been a lot of engagement. This was just kind of a situation in which I was in the room. It's not very often that, you know, I have access like that. And so it seemed like a reasonable point to make. You know, the rest of the week,
I suspect you'll never have access like that again, Alex. But anyway,
that's not true. I mean, the rest of the week, I had meetings with folks who work elsewhere in the administration, and with members of Congress. And you know, we were not only talking about encryption. You know, from our perspective, there's also cybersecurity bills coming down. There's data breach legislation. There's a lot going on in Congress, thanks to the Sony breach and the Anthem breach. There's a lot of desire to move on bills that haven't moved in several years that have just been sitting there. We had a lot of conversations. But, you know, on the encryption conversation, I think there is a lot of willingness to listen. And, you know, once you explain it even to, you know, not very technical legislative analysts and such, they understand very quickly that this is not an easy thing to fix.
You think we might be jumping the gun a little bit by jumping up and down and saying, well, the US government's trying to take away our cryptos.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be, I don't think it's premature to push back, you know, Admiral Rogers said that he's looking for a conversation, right? And so I don't think it's premature for us on the other side to
give it to him.
To share our thoughts on this. I mean, that's not, you know, it shouldn't be a personal thing. It's not too close for that, but it is a little difficult to mobilize big companies and their public policy teams until you have something very specific to talk about, right? And right now there's nothing specific, and there seems to be disagreement in the administration itself. So I think right now is a good time for folks to share it. I hope that my colleagues are sharing this, their opinions on a more private basis, both the people in the administration and in Congress.
Now, 2 weeks ago, when I reached out to you to organize this this interview, it had the press call a dust up with the NSA. That had not actually happened. I wanted to get in touch with you to talk about a keynote speech you did at an AppSec conference in early February, where you gave a presentation and there were many sections to it. One of them I found most interesting was like when you actually started looking at using, you know, hardware security appliances at scale and how much it doesn't work. I think you calculated that for one project, you would have needed enough, so many firewalls, it would have required as much power as like a mid-size US town. Do you think most people in the InfoSec community are aware of just how much scale changes the decisions that you have to make as compared to a typical enterprise?
No, I don't think they are, which is why I keep on beating up that subject whenever I go to conferences. Because it's not, you know, while this is an issue right now for us and for Google and for Amazon and for Facebook, it's going to become an issue for other folks because, you know, in 10 years, 100 gigabit Ethernet connections between switches and having all of your servers on 10 gigi or multiple 10 gigi or on 40 gigi and saturating those connections is probably not going to be something that you only see at web scale, maybe just in 5 years. And when we start to talk about those speeds, there's really nothing you can purchase that works economically for you. And I think in the vendor community, there's very little understanding of this. Like the vast majority of products that people want to sell me, I can disregard within the first 90 seconds just from understanding that, you know, how is it deployed and what kind of speeds does it operate at? Because you're talking about 2-3 orders of magnitude off of what would be economical.
They're trying to sell you a garden tap to control a large dam, really, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, something like that. And I mean, part of it is that some of these products grow up in the corporate world, right? That they're built specifically for the corporate campus scenario in which, you know, 10 gigabits of connectivity is a significant corporate campus for most folks, but that's nothing for a data center, right? Where we're running tens and tens of terabits per second. The other problem is that there's a lot of targeting of companies that have much lower bandwidth needs and much higher profitability per user and much smaller infrastructures. If you look at the largest US banks, you're talking about 40, 50 million customers, very few of whom are using their banking website at any one moment, right? Whereas, you know, people who use Facebook or Twitter or Yahoo or Google, probably most of them have an application that is connecting back to us every 15 seconds or is holding an open SSL connection at all times. And so you end up with these situations where, you know, a large bank can run their entire web app off of 50 or 30 front-end servers and are handling a number of users that we would have to close any single one of our, you know, at their max, is less than the break even for any one of our products, right? And so the economics are totally blown out when you're talking about supporting thousands of concurrent users instead of tens of millions of concurrent users, and that you're able you're making hundreds of dollars per user instead of cents or single dollars per user. Mm. And so, you know, I think that's part of the problem.
And then you've got, I mean, you've also got the problem that you highlighted so well, which is you've got sort of this containerization approach. You've got things moving around everywhere. Even if you could IDS or, you know, network appliance, all of this stuff, keeping track of it anyway is going to be a complete nightmare. So, you know, I guess the question is, like, what do you do? It sounds like you have to roll everything yourself. You have to do everything yourself. You have to rely on your apps to actually report funny stuff rather than network appliances. You know, do you wind up, do you think, though, with a net gain, or is it just about doing what you can, just about doing what's possible? Or do you think that, you know, your approach could probably be a better approach than the one that is typically taken by the enterprise?
I think you can end up in a better place if you're thinking about it from the outset, right? If you end up with all your apps and containers with no state stored locally, and with the ability to roll those very quickly and to patch very quickly, and good agile development processes that roll straight into a CI/CD system, and with, you know, doing access control enforcement via encryption instead of via access control checks in the database. You know, if you do those kinds of basic things when you design it, you can end up in a much better place. Where it's going to get tricky for folks is if you take the same old PHP app that you've been relying upon and you do the minimum amount necessary to just throw it into a container, you're not going to end up with any of those security benefits, and you're going to end up with some of the downsides.
Now, another thing that you spoke about a fair bit was bug bounties, and I thought some of your comments there were very interesting. You know, you basically said that the crowds of the hordes of people who are taking part in these bounties basically need to grow the f*** up because there's definitely an entitlement mentality that's crept into it. You know, they would have gone to prison a few years ago. Now they're actually getting paid, but they want the money yesterday, and they're sort of brattish. You also mentioned that there could be some risks to bug bounty programs through legislation like the CFAA. Do you think it's possible that we could see a prosecutor in the United States charge someone for participating in a bounty if they take off with some user data or something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, those were your words as to describe the bug bounty participants. But I definitely do agree that there is a bit of a basic attitude problem where a lot of the participants in bug bounties don't remember the bad old days, like you and I and other people with some gray hairs of, you know, the 90s and early 2000s, when it was, you know, there was no legal way to perform any kind of security research on a remote app like a web app. And if you reported a bug in one, you're taking your freedom in your own hands, or you had to do so as completely not anonymously as possible. Mm. So things have changed an incredible amount in the last 5-6 years. I think that's a wonderful thing, but we're in a, you know, there needs to be a little bit of remembrance of how far things have gone, and an acknowledgement that things can roll back very quickly, and not just because of, you know, actual criminal prosecution, but if you look at the companies that are running open bug bounties, where, you know, The closed bug bounties, I think, have a good system in that they're providing a certain level of assurance and vetting, and those are going to be a lot easier to consume if you're a more staid, old-school company than the open bug bounties. But if we want the open bug bounty model that anybody can come and report a bug and then probably get paid, if we want that to spread beyond the big tech companies, we're going to have to figure out, as both on both sides of the bug bounty model, how that works, and some kind of basic rules of the road, and, you know, what is polite and what isn't. Because to a certain extent, kind of the traditional, there's a bug, it gets fixed, there's a huge press cycle about it, there's a bunch of PR that happens, that model can destroy the bug bounty model, right? And, you know, what I was thinking of when I put this into my talk is, just a couple of months ago, there was a Facebook bug where you could, like, delete photos where you can see somebody else's photo. So if you have access to see somebody else's photo, there was a parameter tampering bug where they weren't doing an access control check, and you could issue the delete command via the API. Interesting bug. It was reported to Facebook through their bug bounty. They paid for it. That should have been it. But then there's a whole series of press about what a horrible thing it was. And of course, lots of technical misunderstandings of one person could have deleted every photo on Facebook and such. Joe Sullivan and his team are highly dedicated to the bug bounty model, but if there's enough of that happening, then eventually the PR and legal teams are going to come back and say, we're going to take this away. You're not going to be able to pay money to people who are then going to go flog the, you know, bugs out to the press for self-aggrandizement and for getting their name out there, you're not going to be able to create like a community of people who are blackmailing us every day with bugs.
I'm not really sure. Like, for being someone who's familiar with the PR and sort of media side of things, I'm just not sure that that's actually how that could go down. I mean, I understand that there would be a temptation in some companies to sort of take away those programs because they're, you know, they're adding PR risk, but I think they'll be left behind. You know what I mean? Because there's enough value in it that people are going to keep doing it. And I think it's probably going to be the media that's going to learn that, hey, bugs are bugs and they're kind of everywhere. You know, so I'm not so pessimistic about that one.
Right. I mean, hopefully that happens, because honestly, like a completely honest headline for that article would have been Facebook bug bounty works exactly how it's supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Like, but that, I mean, you notice, that was the accurate.
You notice that we don't see screaming headlines every time someone defaces a website and says anonymous was here anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right,
my colleagues and I, we get there in the end. Go on.
So I don't think Facebook or any of us would actually take away the bug bounty model. I think what could happen for the big companies is we could end up with an NDA model where unless you sign an NDA, you don't get paid, which I think would be a detriment, because I do like the idea that reporters are able to publicly talk about the bugs they found and use that to build up their resumes. It's a spectacular way.
Well, let's get on the resume. Logic bloody circular roundabout here, you know, yeah. Because if you go NDA and it all goes quiet, there's less motivation for, you know, there's less, executives have less insight to sort of, you know, support the idea of having the program in the first place. So, right. It's all so much fun dealing with non-security people who make these decisions, isn't it?
It's not, I mean, I don't think that's where we should go, but I'm just saying that would be a more likely outcome from the tech companies if we continue down this path of the way some people in the bug bounty world are acting. So that's what I'm saying, like, there needs to be kind of, if not rules that are legally enforceable, a little bit of better, we need a Peggy post for bug bounties, right? There needs to be a basic etiquette.
There needs to be a better culture, one that isn't about entitlement and shaming victims, you know? Like, I'm totally with you on that. You know, you did mention the CFAA, though, in your AppSec talk. I mean, while I've got you here, and we're going to have to wrap it up soon because we're running out of time, but while I've got you here, I am really curious to know what your thoughts are on the CFAA, because I am yet to meet someone, and I mean anyone, who thinks the CFAA is a sensible law as it is now, it looks like any movement in that law is going to be in the wrong direction. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on it as it pertains to bug bounties and as it pertains to security research generally.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly a neutral party on the CFAA. I was Aaron Swartz's expert witness for his defense. So certainly if what Aaron did falls under the CFAA and could get a person threatened with decades in prison, then I certainly don't think the CFAA has to be broader or have more stringent penalties, right? It's clearly Aaron was caught on the outside corner. There's no need to make it bigger. As for where it applies to bug bounties, I mean, the prosecution of somebody under the CFAA who participated in a bug bounty and stepped out of line intentionally, I think, is inevitable, right? Because there are going to be people who can't resist the temptation to go. They found SQL injection, and now they want to dump out everything and show their friends. And now they've crossed a line where the company can no longer ignore it because there's been real damage to the users, and it's triggered like a it's, you know, especially under some of the cyber breach notification laws, where it's going to trigger a bunch of more legal impact for the companies. There's no way the company's not going to be able to refer that to law enforcement.
How is that, you know? This comes back to the culture thing as well, doesn't it? Which is, you've got to be able to drill into these people, to drum into these people who are participating in these bounties, you know, where that line is. And that's a conversation that we've been having in the InfoSec industry with, you know, actual InfoSec professionals have been having that conversation for a very long time. And if we can't understand that, I wonder how your average bug bounty participant is going to know where to draw it. I mean, most are. But I mean, you've got to have some outlier, like not even outliers, like 10% of these people are not really going to understand that there are limits to these programs. So, I mean, that does seem like a realistic scenario to me.
Well, like you were talking about last week, just from a language perspective, right? You know, we can't translate our rules into every single language or every person who might participate. So it's easy to look at the rules and to slightly misunderstand one English word and to step over. But I'm not as concerned about that. I think certainly what you're going to have people who think the bug bounty gives them cover to then do truly nefarious things, who report a bug and then the company goes back to see if that bug's ever been exploited, which is a standard thing, and then finds out that that same person did exploit it and sold, you know, made some money off of that. And then that's going to be like a fake controversy because people are going to say X company prosecuted this guy. They broke the rules of bug bounty, but it's going to be that was actually a bad guy who was just trying to double dip on a bug. That's inevitable. I think where we need – where the etiquette can solve things is for the accidental missteps of – you know, companies need to take into account, you know, whether or not somebody misstepped intentionally. Like, did they spider a site and all of a sudden their spider went off site and went out of bounds? Or did they not understand when they exploited the bug that it would cause damage to the user and they only did that one time, right? And they didn't do it over and over again. And I think that's the etiquette on the company side. And on the reporter side, there just needs to be a better understanding that bug bounties are not a magical shield that get you out of any kind of legal liability. The real problem here is explaining these things to prosecutors where, you know, very possibly we can end up in a situation where you have somebody, you know, I could totally see a scenario where somebody who's a regular, reasonably white hat bug bounty participant does something gray hat or black hat on the side. The prosecutor can't get them for that for whatever reason, an evidentiary reason or something. And so they look at that person's entire history and they try to get them for that, right? And that's where I think it's going to get real dangerous is, you know, prosecutors have this feeling that that's a bad guy. I want to get the bad guy. They don't really care how, right? You know, they got Al Capone with tax evasion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of – and so that's where we're going to have to be real careful and hopefully, you know – that whatever companies are involved will stand up and publicly say something. But as we know, that's not our decision of what happens. And the U.S. is not the only country where this is going to be an issue. Almost every country in the world has an equivalent of the CFAA. Several of them are explicitly modeled on the CFAA. And so this could happen anywhere in any country where either the user data that was impacted, one of those users was in that country or the reporters in that country or where they are claiming some kind of crazy jurisdiction because there's a data center there or they the attack transited or something.
Jurisdictional nonsense is so much fun. Look, we're going to have to wrap it up in just a minute, but I had a couple of questions come in for you via Twitter. If we could just cover these off quickly, that'd be great. Probably Lying of Twitter asks, does Yahoo contribute to upstream open source security libraries and should companies compete on security?
Yes, we do. So we're participants in GRR. We've checked in a lot of code to the Google Rapid Response toolkit to make it more operational for other folks than Google to run it and as well as to add some features. We've released a bunch of our own open source stuff. We've checked code in to the core end-to-end. So on March 15th, I'm going to be talking at South by Southwest, and we're going to demonstrate where we are with the end-to-end encryption and then release the code for the Yahoo-specific code. But we have been contributing back to kind of the shared back-end code, the crypto code that we share with Google, although the front ends are starting to differ by a significant amount. So we do that a lot. And no, I think it's good for companies to compete by trying to build products that are more trustworthy than their competitors' products. I don't think any of us compete in security in a way that it's to our detriment. I mean, I know I'm trying to have it both ways, but you know, the CISOs of all the major tech companies, we all only have L's in our P&L statements. We don't make our companies any money, right? So it's real easy for us to get along well with Google and Facebook and Twitter and our other colleagues in the tech industry. You know, we share data, we share tools.
Yeah. So it's less of a consideration for someone in your point of view then, I guess.
It is, because I mean, part of it is the entire industry is going to sink or swim based upon whether users trust us over the next decade, right? And so if something horrible happens to Facebook, it does not benefit Yahoo. It makes things worse for us because if users say, I can't trust Facebook, they're not going to think so well of our app. That's, you know, two buttons over in the same row, right? And so, you know, just from even if we're not trying to be good guys, from a purely practical standpoint, we all need to prop each other up and do a good job. Although I think it is a good thing for the companies to try to build products that are make their users feel like they're trustworthy and to compete on the front end.
Okay. Well, Alex Stamos, we've covered a whole bunch of stuff. Thank you so much for coming onto the show to actually update us on what you've been up to, which is an awful lot. And we'll look forward to seeing what news, what headlines you generate over the next month. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Patrick.
Alex Stamos there with this week's feature interview. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay, CTO and co-founder of Sanitas, makers of fine, fine hardware security equipment, hardware crypto stuff, basically. Do check them out. S-E-N-E-T-A-S. And they're a company on the move, too, with a massive increase in profit in the last 12 months and some great plans for the future. And I'm guessing these guys probably owe Ed Snowden a beer. Julian joined me this week to discuss a raft of crypto news, starting off with the Freak vulnerability, which, as best I can tell, isn't actually a giant fireball heading towards Earth, despite what some of the tech press may be saying. Here's Julian.
So, I mean, most of the stories have been about the, you know, the fact that it, this is all predicated from the 90s crypto wars 1.0, when the export restrictions were in place for weakening crypto, for all the algorithms that were exported outside the US. So people are saying, here, this is proof that what you're trying to do today, the arguments around we need to fundamentally weaken the encryption of our modern systems, is fundamentally flawed. And it's come back to bite us 10, 15 years later. So learn your lessons, guys.
Which, we should probably explain what the bug is, which is, you know, it's possible to force some clients to, or some clients will connect using weak ciphers. You can force them to connect using weak ciphers to servers that accept them. But we should also point out that any commercial or non-commercial vulnerability scanner worth its salt, for about the last 10 years, if you point it towards an SSL'd website, the first thing it will notice is that if it accepts those ciphers or null ciphers, it will tell you that and say you might want to fix that up to stop weak clients from being able to connect with weak ciphers. So really, unless you're connecting to an organization that is ignoring Nessus, you know, ignoring really basic security advice, you should be in the clear. And yet people are portraying it as being a very substantial threat.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So it's trying to do a man-in-the-middle attack to fall back to a 512-bit RSA key, which then you can crack in a few hours on an AWS cluster. And you're right about the Nessus stuff, but I mean, you know, how many organizations that we widely use do actually do things properly and are going to run Nessus across it and actually be aware of that vulnerability and turn it off?
Yeah, I'm guessing Facebook and banks and anyone who has anything at all invested in running a halfway decent SSL config is going to bother with it. Do you know what I mean?
I'd certainly hope so, but I just wonder in practice, if we actually looked at it, you know, I don't know what the answer is to that, but if you actually looked at it and looked at the numbers, I bet there's an awful lot of organizations, big ones that we use day to day that don't.
Including NSA.gov, which is actually pretty funny.
Yeah, that was a beautiful one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Although that was an Akamai CDN network, but even so, it's a good story.
Yes, as the Bondi hipsters would say, it's totes irony. So yeah, I mean, look, it's not going to be difficult for these vendors to push a patch, and I can't imagine the impact is going to be substantial, but people are carrying on like we're talking about another Heartbleed, you know? It just seems like, and probably because they gave it a cool name.
Yeah, look, I think it's probably been oversold, as you said, but, you know, it's a good story. And like I said, it really builds on, you know, it seems like every week now, there's some major vulnerability that comes out, and they all kind of build on each other. People are kind of, oh, here's another one, you know?
Yeah. People get primed, don't they, to actually talk about it?
They've all got cool names. What's next week's cool name going to be? But it's probably been overplayed a little bit. Mm. But I think the point about, you know, the genesis of this problem was in, you know, a philosophy in the 90s that we needed to fundamentally weaken crypto to protect ourselves, and that's going to come back and provably going to come back and bite you. And there's no such thing as, you know, having a backdoor that only one guy can use.
And we're hearing from, you know, David Cameron in the UK and Barack Obama in the United States, you know, that they are concerned by the, you know, the free availability of very good encryption technology. We just heard from Alex Stamos of Yahoo. And as we heard then, I mean, probably one of the most likely scenarios is that the US government will expand the Kalia program that applies to telcos to sort of force tech companies to allow interception. Of course, nothing's been proposed yet, but this seems like one way that they would do it. And of course, that rules out entire architectures, doesn't it? It forces people to engineer products that they can actually intercept.
Exactly. And we're really not learning the lessons that we learned from the 90s in that regard. And Obama this week, I mean, he seems to be saying it's okay to do this in the US, but it's not okay to do this in China. That's his rule. Mm. And Cameron's saying, you know, encryption's a problem. So if you build your house with wooden or steel doors, that's too hard for the government to get into. So we're going to replace everybody's front door with a paper front door so we can make it nice and easy to get in. You know, that's the equivalent of what he's trying to say, I think. So, I mean, I think what we can learn from that, though, is that actually strong encryption is actually working. So we know that if it wasn't, these guys wouldn't be worried about it. They're actually coming out and saying, hey, hang on, this crypto is causing us a problem. So that gives me confidence. And Snowden said the same thing, which is that well-implemented, good key management, strong encryption is actually doing the job it's supposed to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, the more nervous they are, the less nervous we should be, I guess.
Exactly. That's right.
But you also make the point. We had a chat before we fired up this interview. You also mentioned that, you know, there is a tangible move now to a culture where encrypting everything is the new norm. I mean, this is kind of what we hoped would happen after the first tranche of Snowden docs hit the press. But it seems to be actually there's follow through there. It is actually happening, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I mean, I certainly anecdotally from our world, you know, we work with a lot of customers all over the world, and certainly we're continuing to see a big Snowden effect. So a lot of people are now choosing to encrypt their networks by default, which is a real change in their posture. You know, we're moving to an all-encrypted web. So, you know, HTTPS isn't computationally expensive anymore. Mm. And a big part of this, I think, is a cultural change. I mean, I don't know if you saw that. Google released a version of Chrome earlier this year that has a feature that actually shows you if you connect to a website that isn't encrypted. Now, that feature isn't turned on by default, but it will be enabled, I imagine, in a future version. So it's actually going to become very visible now if a website isn't encrypted. Now, it sounds like a small, trivial thing, but I think culturally, in terms of educating the community and actually what people's expectations are, that's the sort of thing that we need to actually get people thinking everything should be encrypted. You know, it's not a I only encrypt my bank link network, everything else isn't. We'd need it everywhere.
I saw a really interesting presentation by Peter Gutman many years ago where he was talking about SSL warnings, or not so much warnings, but you know, psychological studies have proven that people won't notice the absence of something that is sometimes there. So like a padlock, like an SSL padlock, you are not going to notice the absence of that. But as we're moving to a place where, you know, Google is prioritizing the page rank of encrypted sites and, you know, pretty much let's encrypt rolls out halfway through this year, which is a fabulous initiative, which is going to make it trivial for people to actually encrypt their whole site and just make that happen. So the idea that we're moving towards a situation where you'll get a warning if something isn't encrypted, I mean, that's, you know, it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think it's a big cultural, educational thing that we need to get people to start expecting and demanding that. And then also you look at, you know, HTTP/2's on the way. You know, that's based on the Google Speedy protocol. That's got encryption built in. It's not mandatory everywhere.
It's not mandatory, though. And I've got to say, I was quite surprised to see that when they're like, they debated it internally and it's not enforced by default. And I just thought, well, why not?
I know. That's disappointing. But Firefox and Chrome will only support it when it is using TLS. So it will always encrypted in those browsers. So again, you know, it's a momentum towards it.
It's an interesting protocol, isn't it? Because it's a binary protocol and you don't need the same number of connections. And I know, like, if Chrome is misbehaving on me, sometimes I'll need to kill it and then restart it. And, you know, being a journalist, you know, having a bunch of news tabs open and stuff like that, when I restart it and say, yeah, restore my tabs, you know, my state tables in my poor little, you know, crapware home router just freak out. So I think That's going to be an interesting change, isn't it, for people running ISP environments and handling a lot of state, a lot of connections. It's going to make their life easier.
Yeah, I'm a bit like you. I usually have multiple Chrome windows open, each with lots of tabs, and it is a big resource hog. So I think, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how much difference it makes. I've heard sort of 30, 40% difference to certain web servers. So certainly streamlining it under one connection binary, sending the content over the binary file is going to be, I imagine, make a huge difference. So I'm pretty excited about that.
And it's going to be the larger companies that, you know, make use of this because there's tangible savings for them there. As soon as the browsers support it, they're going to use it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's going to get adopted pretty quickly. And I think Google's ended support for Speedy now, haven't they? And it's all been folded into HTTP too. So that's good.
That's
excited.
All happening. Yeah, now, look, that's all happening. So why is it that you think they decided not to encrypt?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the things I was pleased to see at the end of last year was that both iOS 8 and Android were going to encrypt everything by default on your phone, you know, allegedly to a level that even Apple or Google couldn't decrypt. But I see this week that in the latest version of Lollipop, that's no longer mandatory. And the reason that they're citing is still performance constraints. Mm. I guess that's because there's, you know, thousands of different Android phones out there with various levels of good and poor CPU capability. So maybe it was a performance consideration as well.
For
some older systems. But, you know, you have to think over time as we move to elliptic curve processing, that problem's going to go away because it's so much more efficient.
Yeah. All righty. Well, Julian Fay, that's all we're going to have time for. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll be chatting to you a few more times this year. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Julian Fay of Sanitas there with some news from the world of crypto. Big thanks to Sanitas for its support of this show. Don't forget to go to sanitas.com and check out their gear, especially if you're looking at hardware encryption devices. These guys make very, very nice kit. And that is it for this week's show. I caught this week's feature track on Triple J, actually. It's an unearthed track by an indie band called Rainy Day Women, and it is called Mars. I'll drop a download link into this week's show notes. It's a freebie. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.